The Wine Bowl of Freedom, Hector and the Women of Troy, Part 3.
"But come on now, have pity, and stay here upon the wall," says Andromache, telling Hector what she wants from him in one succinct line. She has been perched like an owl upon the tower, and has seen the course of battle from above. As Helen's earlier viewing with Priam would indicate, it is difficult to make out the individual players at such a distance. She has seen the war like a strategist looking over a map. Hers is a godlike perspective. She wonders that some of the Achaean heroes have known to attack the wall where it is most scalable. Her speech ends with the comment that they must have heard an oracle, or perhaps it is simply that their spirit urges them. But she needs no oracle or hunch. She can see for herself. If they station the army in a defensive posture by the fig tree, and the rest, including General Hector, remain within the wall, Ilium would no doubt be impregnable. There is every indication that the town could outlast a siege. There is a lesson here often repeated in the Iliad about the futility of the truth. The wise and sometimes even the obvious plan is impossible to implement for various infuriatingly human reasons. Why, after all, can Helen never be returned each time the proposition comes up? The conjunction of Andromache and Hector is not, however, simply brains and brawn. The wisdom of her plan is tainted by its detachment. In war, as elsewhere, the reality looks different from the ground. Her strategy is, in a sense, Periclean, but it lacks the Athenians' naval rhetoric, which might have given some outlet to the masculine imagination, frustrated, humiliated, and penned in a city crowded by the farm folk and racked with a plague, as their crops were ravaged by the Spartans with impunity. Hector responds in his aspect of the Great One, Flashing Helm, Megas korutaiolos Hector. "All these things concern me too, woman, but most dreadfully do I feel shame before the Trojans and the Trojan ladies, their robes trailing, if like a coward off afar I shrink from war." The dreadful shame is indeed a disjunctive conjunction of ideas, embodied in the music by enjambment. The terror of such shame, as he addresses her in his flashing helm, would perhaps be most evident to Andromache. He fears less to make her a widow than to face the women of Troy as a coward. But he has more motive than this terrible shame. He seems to respond to Andromache's last line, the last thing she ever says to him alive, that perhaps the Achaeans know to attack the weak spot in the wall because their spirit bids them. There is something she admires in her enemies about their instincts. Well, his own life's breath bids Hector not to shrink back. But there is still more to his motive, as he immediately says. He has learned to be a brave man, always to fight amongst the front ranks of the Trojans, winning great repute, Megacleos, for his father, and for himself as well. The trauma of war inflicted upon community, culture, and the individual psyche yields in this fearsome learning to the theatre of war as the stage for the action of masculine excellence. Andromache once married a favourite son, but he has learned to be a warrior. Whether he has heard an oracle or whether his own heart prompts him is not clear, but Hector claims to know that the day will come when holy Ilium and Priam and the people of Priam Good Ash are destroyed. He yields to his fatalism, meekly it would seem, and launches into a remarkable imaginative reverie. He answers the story of the real loss of Andromache's parents and siblings with the imagined loss of his own. But of all their dearest kin still living and present in Ilium, he says, he shall grieve for none so much as for her. Achilles has singled out Andromache by making her an orphan. Hector has singled her out, perhaps one should say orphaned her, or perhaps one should say widowed her.
with his love. He imagines the loss of her day of freedom, Eleuteronamar. Some bronze-shirted Achaean will lead her away in tears. He sees her plying the loom and carrying water in Messeis or Hyperea. One wonders what these places mean to Hector. Is this profoundly homebound man a traveller in his imagination? Perhaps there are Argives listening for whom the named place's rusticity adds a certain poignancy. At the heart of his reverie, he imagines some Argive yokel seeing her in tears. He keeps imagining her in tears, but he is not himself crying as I picture it. And the fellow says, "That's Hector's wife, the one who used always to be the champion in the fighting amongst the Trojans, the horse tamers, when they fought around Ilium. The glory, the great repute that he has studied to win, this best of the tamers of horses, will be sung on the lips of such a nobody in response to such a sight." This is all very felt. There is self-mockery here, but is he not also very self-indulgent? As he finishes his speech, I hear the emphasis on his wanting to die and his horror at the picture of her, rather than his ability actually to experience her fate projectively, and hence to sympathize, and very far from any attempt to touch her and to comfort her. What happens next, however, is a revelation. He reaches out for his child. Homer now refers to him as Shining, Paidimos Hector. There is a play in the line between Paidos, child, and the epithet. Hu Paidos orexato Paidimos Hector. The child shrinks back to the bosom of his nurse, swerving away with a cry in fear at the visage of his own dear father, fearful of the bronze and the horsehair crest which he marked. Noesas, something more than simply saw, nodding dreadfully from the crown of his father's helmet. The child recognizes the transformation of his father, that what he sees both is and is not his father. This is why Homer says that it is his dear own father, Patros Pilo, that he shrinks from. What the child recognizes, perhaps also the parent. He is an armed man in the city. Worse, he is an armed man intruding upon the feminine world of nurse and mother, the world of the warrior's infant. Worse yet, he is no longer what he had used to be in this world. More fearsome than a god, his softness and strength have been transmuted. His hair has become horse's hair, his head brazen. Through the eyes of a child, at long last, Hector catches sight of himself. Ek dege lasse pater te pilos kai potnia mater. This is their consummation, the dear father and the queenly mother, in the grip of their mortal imaginings, both laugh out loud. Do they laugh at their fearful child, at Hector, at each other, at themselves? I have heard a number of stupid things in my time about the causes of laughter. This time let me leave you with Homer's foreground. They laughed out loud. Hector immediately removes the offending helmet and places it upon the ground. This amounts to an unmasking of Hector Korutaiolos. The helmet is a resplendent thing upon the earth, epiktoni pampano orson. But beneath it is the light of Paidimos Hector. He kisses his son and shakes him in his hands, then makes a prayer to Zeus and the other gods that the boy become like him, preeminent among the Trojans, just so strong and brave, and that he rule Ilium mightily. What has happened to the thing Hector well knew in his mind and heart, that holy Ilium was to be destroyed? I believe he still knows it. What is important and somehow self-substantial is the content of his wish. There is no thought of fulfillment. He prays that someone come to say that his son is a much better man than his father as he returns from war. This is to institutionalize the canon of excellence he has learnt that depends upon a theatre of war. This is therefore to wish that war be a permanent, or at least a regular, condition. The chaos of war, which has been the ruin of Andromache's life, is prayed by Hector to be the scene of their son's virtue. A better man than him. Achilles was the destroyer of Andromache's childhood home, and Hector wishes his son to be an Achilles on the home front. The whole speech seems to me to turn, however, on its final half line. Carea de prenamater. May she be pleased in her mind, his mother. Mother is the last word, only after it sounds do the preceding words become feminized. The thing might have been expressed as a result clause, that is to say, may he bear home the bloody spoils of a foeman he's slain, that his mother be pleased in her mind. Instead, we have a separate wish. Spoken in front of her, this final wish suggests that although the prayer is addressed to the gods and spoken over the boy, it is directed at Andromache. The little half line touches the whole scene into a new dimension. The removal of the helmet, the kissing and the lifting and the praying over the boy become a most telling drama as one understands them to have been played for the wife standing by. May she be pleased is the best that Hector can do. Let us say that he knows there is no argument that can reconcile him to her, that there is no way to square the husband with the warrior. He will widow his life's best love because he must follow his spirit's bidding to fight in the front line. What he can do is try to persuade her that it is not vainglory that motivates him. Out of his fatalist reverie he reaches for their son, as if to demonstrate that it is somehow for her and for theirs that he chooses to risk his life. It is unusual that a hero, or a god, pray to be topped by his son. This also is for Andromache's ears. The gesture and the prayer of Hector unmasked are a dramatization of his motive where no argument can be had. Rapidly we have seen a Hector variously blind to himself, a Hector shown to himself through the eyes of a child, a Hector unmasked, and as I see it, a Hector so phenomenologically self-aware as to dramatize himself and his appearance, his helmet removed and naked in his contradictions, for an audience of one. As for his wife, in the absence of an argument, he can only pray that she be pleased. The prayer is that she be pleased with their son, but surely it is first of all a prayer that she be pleased with his father. In the indirection of this wish, let us hear a kind of proposal. As with Isabella and the Duke in Measure for Measure, we never hear if Andromache says yes. As she receives the child to her bosom, suffice it to say, with Homer, that there are now tears mixed in with her laughter. Her husband noted this, says Homer, again, noesas, and took pity on her. Now there is no name, no epithet. Amidst the variety of Homer's evocative options in naming Hector, here he is simply Posis, husband. Still unmasked, he takes her hand and says, Daimonia, mem moi telian akakis deo tu moi, o gartis muperaisan aner awidi proiapsi. Moi rando tina pami pepog menon emmenai andron, o kakon ode menestlon epin taprota genatai. Allis hoi codiosa tas autas verga comisde, histon tala catente, cae ampi poloisi ca leue, vergone poicestai. Polemos dandressi me lasi, pasi, malista de moi, toi ilioi engega asin. Divinity, do not on my account grieve yourself too much at heart, for there is no one, no man, who beyond my fate will throw me forth into Hades. No one escapes his portion. I say no such man exists, not a coward, not even a brave man, from the moment he was first born. But go into the house, and manage the works that do belong to you, the loom and the distaff, and instruct the assistants going back and forth at the work. War shall be the concern of men, all of us, but me especially, of those who are native in Ilium." This speech was very famous in antiquity. Aristophanes milks it in his Lysistrata. War shall be the concern of women, we hear. Its first parodist, however, was Homer in the Odyssey. Telemachus twice steals the lines that tell Andromache to go into the house and supervise the loom. The measly boy substitutes mutos for polemos in one case, speech, which will be the concern of men, and tuxon, the bow, in the other. In both cases, he's trying to put his magnificent mother in her place. The context suggests a relegation of Penelope to the realm of women's work. Hector also is often thought to be putting Andromache in her place. But the emphasis I hear in the lines is not on women's work, but on the work that truly belongs to you, tas autas erga. To begin with, the speech is a recognition in Hector of a theme that I have been advancing, that the attributes united in the divinity he has come to propitiate, Athena, is offered the most skillfully woven cloth in honor of her wisdom, so that she may wield her power in war to break a spear, are of necessity separated in the sexuality and mortality of humankind. Attempts to find unity and wholeness through friendship, or through marriage, or through kinship, are vain imitations and end in failure. The condition of the orphan is forever ours beneath the surface. Athena drives home this point. The poet prefers to drive home rather than merely to illustrate in the cruelty of her treatment of Hector before his death. No sooner do the scales tilt and Apollo and the day depart from his side, but Athena swoops down to egg on the heavy-footed Achilles and to fool Hector. "We two shall win great glory," she says to Achilles in the trope of comrades in arms. She adds that not even Apollo's grovelling before Zeus can save Hector now. This is in Book 22. When she comes to Hector, you may recall that she pretends to be Deiphobus, his full brother, son of Priam and Hecuba. And in the warmth of feeling in his response to his own brothers apparently daring to come out from the protection of the walls and help him, Hector is persuaded to stand and fight. She even has it in her to describe to him how Priam and Hecuba and all their friends begged that he not go out to help Hector. Hector is fooled where most he lives, in his trust in the enduring and saving power of the family. It is in the way that Hector's last words to her intend to touch Andromache herself that the speech is a credit to the man. Perhaps Hector knows or can imagine what it is to be wise and also clever, but to have no power to act. When he comes home and finds Andromache absent, Hector is probably a little disturbed. It is true that he asks her to go back within the oikos, the household, but this is not to put her in her place. He can offer her no alternative to the fate that the two of them have, both in some measure glimpsed, that he will be killed by Achilles like the rest of Andromache's family. But she doesn't have to see it. He sends her home not to control her or oppress her, but to protect her in the only way left, not from the fact, for it is as good as fact, but from the witnessing of it. But even this is not where the emphasis lies. Andromache's is an active intellect. She sees and she thinks. She's a strategist. In later days, even in ancient Athens, naval strategy plays a greater part in the fortunes of war than the prowess of a man in single combat. Perhaps this change, which is past ripe today, should be called a feminizing of warfare. But in the Trojan War, there is no outlet for this mortal Athena, this commandant exiled in Troy's Eyrie. Andromache bears the burden of an exquisite inefficacy. From her perch, she can observe the movements of armies, discern that and how the weak spot is defensible,
even deduce her husband's presence and purpose in the city, and trace a path through Ilium's streets to intercept him, with handmaid and baby son in tow, at the only exit from the labyrinth. I think Hector recognizes something of the miserable anxiety that this burden must bring. What he counsels is a return to the work that she truly owns, a sphere in which her skill has quick consequence, and the command of her attendants in a communal effort. Clearly Hector is unable to keep Andromache at home while he is away. He has no power to put her in her place, but he means to restore her, in the same way but in the opposite direction he means to restore himself, to a place of command and control, and for what we might call her sanity's sake, to a place where her spirit can be invested in the art of work. We find her there at her loom when the outcry at Hector's death reaches her halls. She too will tear off her headdress, the delicate accoutrements with which she is crowned on her wedding day, to sing bare the song of the orphan. She has been embroidering flowers onto a web. These fleurs-de-lis, in their simple elegance, stand in contrast with the extravagant vanity of Helen's self-serving embroideries. They are a fitting emblem for the noble soul that created them, and for the warrior they were meant to enshroud, when at last he was shed of his brazen plates. So they separate. He once again takes up his helmet with a horse's crest, and she returns home holding the baby. Entropa lis domina. This middle-voiced word means either that Andromache kept turning around or turning somehow inward, circling reluctantly to her home. In her formless, grieving spontaneity, she finds herself moving in the timeless form, circling with retrogressions of the Greek round dance. At home, she and her handmaidens raise the lament for Hector while he is still living, because they do not expect him back. Mourning for Hector is thematic. It is all one with mourning for Troy. When Hector really dies, the spontaneous groan of lament which arises from Priam and spreads to all the Trojan onlookers is compared quite pointedly. Homer actually says, "This is what it was most like," introducing not a simile, but a similar object, to a vision of all Ilium consumed from the top of its brow by fire. The fall of Troy is prefigured in the fall of Hector. It is perhaps fair to say that for this poet, the meaning of the fall of Troy is encapsulated in the death of Hector. This is not the understanding of Aeschylus, nor does it have any obvious place in the vision of the poet of the Odyssey. But it helps to explain why the poet of the Iliad ends with the funeral of Hector and with Hector's oral signature. Lest we forget him, here comes Paris bounding along as he had promised. Fully armed now, strutting like a stallion who has broken free of his stall and exults in the freedom, thrilling through his haunches and flowing through his mane, and at the prospect of the loose mares. The stallion is at last a positive and ennobling image of Paris the warrior. Other heroes are lions, bulls, rams. Ajax is once a donkey, but Paris is a stallion. The feeling of freedom and life spirit evoked by the simile is genuine in Homer, but Homer does not lose sight of Paris. His is an escapist freedom. It is felt in the breaking of the bonds of his stall. It is born of excess and surfeit. The horse breaks out, the poet notes, when it has been sated with fodder. The thrill lies at least in part in the illicit quality of the roaming and the mating. It is another sort of man who is a tamer of horses. It is a different sort of freedom that he brings into being. He is as roused by Helen as ever Paris was, but he is the holder, the restrainer, the tamer, the defender. His longing is bridled and reined, but not broken. It is transmuted, but not diminished. The freedom he feels is all one with the freedom of the city, its autonomy, its freedom under law, its aspiration to hold within it such a thing as Helen. Among the common modern teachings is the notion that the Homeric heroes are sorts of static ideals, or worse yet, stock traditional types. One does not look to them for what is often called character development, or any real development at all. But the notion of development is a notion of uncovering, exposing, revealing in the course of time and events what has been present and latent. It does not connote a change in the thing. It is simply the opposite of an envelopment. The episode I have discussed is therefore a development of Hector. This in relation both to us and to himself. Hector had earlier mocked Paris in front of all the troops. You have heard him say to Paris and his own mother, "May the earth gape for him, and if only he were dead." But now, after this series of encounters with the women of Troy, including Helen and culminating with his own wife, has not he seen and felt something of what it means to be a woman's man? And does this not soften him towards his brother? Listen for yourself, and tell me he hasn't changed his tune. This is not a matter of the vindication of Paris, but of reconciliation with him. Divinity! There is no man who is fair-minded who would dishonour your work in battle, since you are valiant. But of your own will you slack off and don't want it. But my own heart grieves within me when about you I hear ugly words among the Trojans who sustain much labour on your account. But let us go. Afterwards we shall make this right, if ever Zeus should grant that we set up for the heavenly gods, the ever-born, a wine bowl of freedom in our halls. Once from the land of Troy we have driven out the well-grieved men of Achaea. It is perhaps strange on the face of it that when they next meet in the Iliad, Hector is once again angry with Paris. It is as if the softening effects of this episode had not occurred. There are, of course, many readers who hardly warm to Hector. His vanity and brutality, it must be said, at other moments are not easily distinguishable from those exhibited in other warriors in both armies. The episode we have just witnessed with Andromache is for many readers the only moment when Hector is in some way reconciled to them. When brothers meet in Dostoevsky, there is always an advancement in their relationship through the course of the novel. How does one register an apparent lack of continuity of this type in Homer? Let me suggest that we are not here dealing with an oralism or something primitive. Rather, it is Homer who is the truer to life. In my experience with siblings, loved ones, even in the classroom, there are often moments of real development. But it is not possible to pick up again where one left off. A great class leaves something of its greatness in the moment. When we begin again, we return to a certain habitual posture towards each other. At the beginning of a seminar, we are names once again, and over the course, gradually, consciously and unconsciously, we acquire a number of characteristic epithets. The very rootedness of an episode in a moment of performance is not some feature born of the necessity of that performance. Rather, it bespeaks a mimetic truth. Life comes to us in moments of concentration and development. It does not come to us in novels. The truth, perhaps, is not episodic, but life and performance are. The Homeric episodes manage to convey a conviction of unity in the design of the whole at the same time that they root their auditor in the moment. Krater asta sastai eleuteron in megaroisin. It is the wine bowl of freedom, kratera eleuteron, that last image in Hector's rapprochement with Paris, with which I would like to leave you in our quest for the enduring significance of Hector. We do not have here a noun, an epithet, phrase. We have instead an object, the bowl, and a rather pointed and provocative predication upon it. I suppose what Hector gives us is literally a free mixing bowl, perhaps a bowl from which free citizens drink, not slaves. There is plenty of predicating in Homer. Not all of his adjectives are epithets, but this style of predication, where the adjective has to be, as it were, unpacked in the translation, is Aeschylean. It is typical of the later lyric poets. Hector gives us a lyric moment, a bloom of inward verbal imagery inside the extroverted pulse of epic. The wine is the wine of a still-living covenant. It is the covenant of autonomy and liberty, of self-determination and the pursuits of freedom under law. It is the covenant of the city through which we settle our differences and reconcile ourselves to each other as brother to brother in time of peace. It is also more than this. In the grip of the awesome necessity set down upon us by the gods as Homer knew them, directed toward these gods in their contradictions, their mysterious unities and cruel partiality, ever born and born forever, in the face of our orphan mortality, this wine bowl of freedom in the heart of a community represents a rather defiant dedication. It has freedom's metaphysical import. It is a cry of the will. Of course, the vision of freedom's bowl set up in Ilium for the heavenly gods is never realized for Hector. The episode dramatizes a failed mission, but it is his capacity to frame such an image in the face of a disintegrating world. This image, which is, to my mind, one of the most moving in all literature, a wine bowl of freedom in the halls, which sets him apart and helps to make Hector, tamer of horses, a name still worthy of song on the lips of an humanity not yet born. This is Hector's own poetry, an image which comes from him and which objectifies his longing. How different from the vengeful greed of the Achaeans, or even from the bleakly heroic resignation of the Trojan allies, Sarpedon and Glaucus, as they too also prepare to enter the deadly fray. That's in Book 12. "We shall make this right," says Hector. The two brothers are before their own home and city. They know very well that the day of freedom will soon be lost forever, but they will die in thirst for a day of atonement, in thirst for the day of the pouring of Hector's wine. It has been my privilege to serve this wine today at this table. Thanks to Homer, it shall be drunk new forever.